From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Ari Snyder with the news on This Day in Maine, Friday, July 18th, 2025. Immigration lawyers in Maine say President Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill, signed into law earlier this month, will supercharge immigration enforcement and detention. UMaine School of Law professor Anna Welch says $170 billion in additional funding for ICE and Border Patrol will almost certainly lead to more arrests in Maine and across the country.
We're going to see a huge uptick in CBP and ICE officers working in the state of Maine, conducting arrests, doing, you know, those roving stops, checkpoints, et cetera.
The new law also imposes fees on immigrants applying for certain legal protections and further restricts access to federal safety net programs for some immigrants with legal status. The Maine Department of Health and Human Services estimates 3,000 people in the state could lose Medicaid coverage under those new rules. Events across Maine yesterday honored the late Congressman and civil rights activist John Lewis on the fifth anniversary of his passing. Roseanne Grafa organized a quiet vigil in Portland.
My friend and I came up with this idea of just having a small, very focused, positive type of protest. And we also decided that the biggest issue of all the issues we had was the constitutional issues.
Grafa says the event is about consciousness raising and being together. She plans to continue her weekly vigils for as long as she can. A 17-year-old male from Frankfort, Maine, has been charged with one count of murder in the case of Sunshine Stewart, whose body was found in Crawford Pond in Union on July 3rd. The state determined that Stewart, who was last seen paddleboarding alone, died from strangulation and blunt force trauma. She was 48. The teen denied the murder charge during a short court appearance in Knox County via Zoom, according to the Midcoast Villager. Because of his age, Maine Public is not naming him. The state has filed a motion to have the juvenile, who turns 18 in September, tried in adult court. If he is convicted of murder as an adult in Maine, he would face a minimum of 25 years in prison. Late last night, the U.S. House voted to roll back more than $1 billion in previously appropriated funding for public broadcasting. Since then, President and CEO Rick Schneider says Maine Public has received an outpouring of calls and messages from listeners asking what they can do to help.
Really, the way to help is to support your local station, whether you're here in Maine or wherever you are. Supporting your local public radio and public television station is how you can ensure this service is possible.
Maine Public operates nearly 30 radio and television transmitters that broadcast emergency alerts from the National Weather Service and other agencies. Schneider says Maine Public will continue to maintain that infrastructure and that there will be no changes to the emergency alert system in the foreseeable future. The latest chapter in the ongoing debate over the expansion of Juniper Ridge Landfill in Old Town played out at the Penobscot County Superior Court today. At issue is whether the expansion benefits the public. Caitlin Bedion has more.
The Penobscot Nation and Conservation Law Foundation are appealing the state's ruling that the expansion is in the public benefit. They argue the project perpetuates environmental injustice against the Penobscot Nation and contradicts Maine's so-called solid waste hierarchy.
No reasonable mind could have concluded that the public benefit approval ensures environmental justice.
Lawyer Alexandra St. Pierre says pollution from the landfill leachate gets into the Penobscot River watershed and nearby Indian Island, the Penobscot Nation Reservation. She says it's particularly bad now that Juniper Ridge is accepting the vast majority of municipal sewage sludge from around the state, which cannot be taken to other locations because it has been contaminated with PFAS.
They failed to consider the extent of the burden on the Penobscot Nation rather than the fact of the burden, meaning that they considered that the Penobscot Nation is burdened by pollution, but they failed to go further and analyze the gravity and scope of that burden, and then also whether or not the expansion would add to that burden.
Attorney Nora Bosworth adds that landfilling waste is meant to be the last option under the state's solid waste hierarchy, and the state failed to take that into account and failed to require the landfill to adapt new technology to deal with the sludge.
Addressing this would have meant requiring sludge drying and capping the influx of crushed construction waste. Under this decision, watery sludge and the vast amounts of waste used to bulk that sludge will continue to devour a needless amount of space in the one active state-owned landfill in Maine.
But Assistant Attorney General Jack Defoe, representing the Maine Department of Environmental Protection, says the state's decision is consistent with environmental justice standards.
First of all, the conclusion that this project was not inconsistent with environmental justice was supported by substantial evidence.
He says the department did look into the issues raised by the Penobscot Nation and CLF and gave them fair consideration.
If you look at what they've actually complained about, I think, and these are, you know, all legitimate concerns, and these are all things that DEP took seriously.
Defoe argues the department can more effectively add more specific requirements for PFAS treatment later in the licensing process for the landfill. Although Juniper Ridge is owned by the state, it's operated by NewsMe Landfill Operations, a subsidiary of Casella Waste Systems. The company is considered a party of interest to the appeal, and its attorney Brian Rayback says landfills like Juniper Ridge provide a necessary service.
So landfills are easy targets for people who don't like waste. Nobody really likes waste, but they are essential. We need them. They need to be well run. They need to be well regulated. And our view is that's what's happening here.
Justice Bruce Maloney will take the arguments into consideration, but there is no timeline for when he will rule on the appeal. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Caitlin Bedayan.
U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. recently gutted a federal vaccine advisory committee and replaced its members with vaccine skeptics, declaring the move a, quote, major step towards restoring public trust in vaccines. But many in the medical community accuse him of injecting misinformation, confusion, and distrust into the doctor-patient relationship. And as Patty White reports, it's an issue that some doctors in Maine say they're already confronting in the exam room.
Dr. Scott Schiff Slater is a logical guy. When he was deciding on a career path, he considered three things. He wanted to help people. He wanted to live in a rural area. And he loved science.
I actually sat down and figured out, if I combine those three, what would I do? And this was sort of my logical conclusion.
But after more than three decades as a family physician in Hallowell, Schiff Slater says he now struggles to make sense of the public's eroding trust in medicine. During the COVID pandemic, he'd take extra time to address safety concerns raised by patients who were wary of mRNA vaccines. He'd even draw diagrams to show how they work.
People were interested. People would say, oh, tell me about that, and I would show people and explain.
Schiff Slater says he doesn't do that anymore. Skeptical patients don't want to discuss it.
We've kind of agreed to disagree, and we smile about it, and patients will say, oh, yes, I know you want me to get those. You love those vaccines, don't you, doctor?
These interactions leave Schiff Slater frustrated and worried about his patient's health and the misinformation that drives these decisions.
And it's kind of like the battle is lost.
Up the road in Waterville, internal medicine physician Dr. David Preston says some of his skeptical patients have suffered real consequences after declining the COVID vaccine.
One of them came very near to dying and has long COVID and has never recovered. And he did come in and he said, oh gosh, you know, I made a mistake.
Preston says it's likely just a matter of time before another pandemic arrives.
I worry about our ability to control that because you've got this sort of built-in segment of the population that isn't going to go along with the public health measures that are needed to control a serious pandemic.
He points to the current U.S. measles outbreak, fueled by low vaccination rates, in which cases have reached their highest point in more than 30 years. Misinformation about healthcare isn't new, but it has accelerated in recent years. In 2021, the U.S. Surgeon General issued an advisory calling misinformation spurred by social media and political polarization a serious threat to public health.
It's really a daily encounter for us in pediatrics.
Dr. Rebecca Brakely is a pediatric hospitalist at Central Maine Healthcare. She says many parents have been swayed through social media to be more fearful of vaccines than the diseases they prevent.
There's a lot more people with information that they're not sure what to do with. And so parents are really sorting through a lot more than ever before.
Dr. Anne-Marie Latanzi, an emergency medicine physician with Brunswick-based Blue Water Health Partners, sees misinformation's influence even during emergencies. Some patients with internal bleeding reject blood transfusions because they're worried the donor received the COVID vaccine. Others turn to social media platforms instead of doctors for advice.
I've even had an instance where somebody was having a heart attack and was recommended to get the clot-busting medications and wanted to check with their Facebook group before receiving the medications.
Latanzi urges people to remember that physicians have spent years of training to gain expertise, but she understands how difficult it can be for patients in the modern world.
It must be exhausting to feel like that's your responsibility to be making those decisions. Actually, what I really want people to feel is that that's the role of your physician to make those decisions with you and share the information with you.
And if you do seek information online, she says, make sure it's from a credible source.
I think it's...
As Dr. Scott Schiff-Slater demonstrates, that can be challenging.
Sorry, I'm a terrible typist. Website.gov. It's actually literally a .gov site.
He's pulling up a new site hosted by whitehouse.gov that's dedicated to the theory that COVID was leaked from a laboratory. It presents the leak theory as established fact and lists several false or misleading statements about the virus.
This is a scary website to me. I just look at it and I can't even read it.
Schiff Slater says he's worried finding correct information could become even more difficult in the future. The physicians who spoke to Maine Public for this story recommend several credible sources, including the Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, Dana-Farber, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and your doctor. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
And now it's time for Maine's Political Pulse, our regular look at government and politics. This week, I'm joined by Maine Public State House correspondent Kevin Miller. So, Kevin, we should start today's conversation with the so-called rescissions bill that Congress has sent to President Trump. The bill clawed back about $9 billion in spending previously approved by Congress. This is going to have a major impact on foreign aid and on public broadcasting stations like Maine Public. Maine Senator Susan Collins was once again in the national limelight. What role did she play? And can you remind us where the rest of the delegation came down on this?
Yeah, sure, Ari. So all four members of Maine's delegation opposed the rescissions package, but Senator Collins received a lot of the attention because she was one of just two Republicans to vote against it. Collins was very vocal in opposing specific cuts to foreign aid, especially for global AIDS relief and for nutritional programs for pregnant mothers and newborns in impoverished countries. But she also opposed most of the cuts to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting because those funds go to local stations like ours. But in the end, the Republican leadership didn't need the votes from Collins or from Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska because they had Vice President Vance to break the tie.
But Democrats are not giving Senator Collins a pass, are they, even though she did vote against the rescissions package?
Yeah, absolutely not. And this might as well be the opening skirmish in the 2026 battle for Collins' seat, in my opinion. Democrats have hit Collins with a barrage of attacks in recent weeks, accusing her of essentially aiding and abetting the Trump agenda, even when she voted against that agenda. And what I think is most telling, Ari, and why I think this is part of their 2026 strategy, is that they're using Senator Collins' own campaign messaging from 2020 against her. During that race, Collins made the argument that she was poised to become the next Republican chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. This is one of the most powerful positions in Congress because appropriations committees literally control the federal purse strings, and committee chairs have a very long history of directing extra money back home to their states. Well, Collins is indeed now leading the Appropriations Committee. And what Democrats have been saying is the votes on the funding clawback bill and the budget reconciliation bill earlier this month show that either Collins doesn't have that much influence over her Republican colleagues or that she actually is okay with these bills. Collins' office and her campaign fiercely contest that, but that's what we're hearing over and over again now from the main Democratic Party. And here is the vice chair of the party, Imke Schessler, making that allegation during a recent press conference.
The seniority Collins likes to run on means nothing if she's not willing to use it to make sure Mainers aren't denied health care and affordable food.
I think that we're going to hear a lot of the same through November 2026.
Right. So let's talk a bit more about 2026 and potential candidates. Who are the Democrats that are in the race right now?
Well, five Democrats have filed papers with the federal election officials so far. They are Jordan Wood, David Costello, Tucker Favreau, Natasha Alcala, and Andrea LaFlame. But none of these candidates are really well known. David Costello ran against Angus King last year on the Democratic ticket, but he finished third. Jordan Wood has worked at the national level in Washington, D.C., and he's been able to raise, I'd say, a pretty impressive amount so far for his campaign, $1.6 million in just a few months. But he's a political newcomer here in Maine, and I don't think that's everyone who is going to run.
So who else are you hearing that might still jump in?
Yeah, well, the biggest name by far has to be Governor Janet Mills. Her second term as governor ends in 2026, so a lot of Democrats are hoping that she'll challenge Collins. The governor has been pretty noncommittal about this so far, I'd say, but I spoke with someone who is familiar with her thinking this week, and they said that she is still very much considering a run. I'm not sure if that'll happen. I think one of the reasons is Senator Collins and Governor Mills have, at least publicly, had a pretty good working relationship, and this is going to be an intense campaign with lots of national attention. It's going to be all-consuming for the candidates. But if she did, I think that would be quite the race between Collins and Mills. There are a few other names that are circling out there. Attorney General Aaron Fry is reportedly considering it. I spoke with House Speaker Ryan Fecteau earlier today, and he says he's still weighing his options and mulling it over. Former State Senator Kathy Breen of Falmouth is considering running. And then Dan Kleben, who's the co-owner of Maine Beer Company in Freeport, he's said publicly that he's considering running.
And what about Senator Susan Collins? Do we know for sure that she's running?
Yeah, well, she says she intends to run, but Politico had a story earlier this week in the midst of this big fight over the rescissions package, quoting anonymous sources saying that President Trump has been talking about other options if she doesn't run. But her fundraising certainly suggests that she is running, or she's serious about running. She raised $2.4 million over the past few months and has more than $5 million in her campaign account.
Of course, Maine voters will also elect a new governor next year. You had a story earlier this week, Kevin, about all the money that candidates are already raking in. What do you think this tells us about the race more than a year ahead of the election?
I think it shows that this is going to be a pretty competitive race for the primaries. Two Democratic candidates, former House Speaker Hannah Pingree and Secretary of State Shenna Bellows, they each raised more than $500,000 in a few months or even a few weeks. Two more Democratic contenders, Angus King III, who is the son of our current U.S. Senator, he raised more than $400,000, and so did former Senate President Troy Jackson. There are a few other less well-known Democrats in the race, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see others jump in, but it seems to me like at this point, the Democratic primary is pretty much taking shape.
So it sounds like you think the Democratic field is not quite set, but at least sort of solidifying. What about things on the Republican side?
Yeah, I'd definitely say the Republican contest is less complete at this stage. Bobby Charles, who was a former assistant U.S. Secretary of State, he's campaigning pretty hard and raised about $250,000. We've got a few business owners in the mix, such as Owen McCarthy and David Jones. They both raised in the six figures in the past couple weeks. And then State Senator James Libby is running as a clean elections candidate. But I fully expect that we'll see other Republicans get into this race. And I think one name that listeners might recognize is State Senator Laura Libby. She's the Auburn Republican who really thrust Maine into the national spotlight on the issue of transgender athletes with her Facebook posts. And she was also the lawmaker that was censured by the Maine House for those posts and then sued the House Speaker in federal court. So she has openly said that she might run as well.
And that was Maine Public State House correspondent Kevin Miller. You can also read our Political Pulse newsletter. You can find a link to subscribe at mainepublic.org/pulse. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Join us tomorrow morning at 8 for Weekend Edition with Susan Duran. I'm Ari Snyder. Thanks for listening.